I explained. Oh, they're fine. As can be. Outstanding. Okay, Frey, time for you to play Paul Bunyan and knock down some trees to make a hole for your balloons.
Paul Bunyan was American, eh?
She objected. I thought he was French-Canadian, but whatever. Get moving. That other enemy team is closing on your position. The dragon will only have a safe fly corridor for 8 minutes. Durand and her two young passengers were first to rise from the jungle floor, being gently tugged skyward by the nanofiber tether, while the third tree was still sagging over. Katie Frey waited for the other woman's feet to clear the surrounding treetops, then activated her own balloon. Out the top of the pack shot a dart, pulling a hair-thin line behind it. There was a brief moment of panic when branches snapped off the falling tree and nearly tangled the line, but it twisted out of the way and tugged the tightly packed balloon with it.
You sure this can carry both of us?
Grudzian asked, his question prompted by nervous energy rather than fear. He knew that in a pinch a single balloon could pull aloft two mech-suited figures, though it was best to ditch all their other gear. He still had his rifle, and Captain Fraze was securely attached to her suit. They were as ready as they could be.
Don't sweat it, Groots, she replied without taking her eyes off the expanding balloon. Frey Airlines has never lost a passenger yet. Good. Will there be snacks on this flight?
The tether began gently lifting them off the ground. It felt more like an elevator than a carnival ride.
Snacks? If you don't keep your mouth closed, you might swallow a bug.
Justin Grudzian turned his head to watch the ground fall away beneath his feet.
A bug? I need a comment card. This airline sucks.
Chapter 39.
Hey, Joe!
Skippy interrupted while I was watching the two storks approach the island with the camp we had designated as Objective Dixie.
You like trivia, right?
If he had said a simple, hey, Joe, I might have given him a distracted yes and hoped he'd drop the subject. Because he dragged it out into a hey, Joe, I knew that whatever he was going to tell me, I wasn't going to like it.
I hate trivia, Skippy. Can this wait until Smythe has the situation under control?
He didn't directly answer my question.
Here's a fun fact for you. The Theranin are already here!
Huh? What the f- They just jumped into orbit? My finger was poised over the transmitter to issue a general recall, but I couldn't tell my people what the egress plan was until I knew what the hell was going on.
Nope. They arrived 2 days ago, jumped in about 10 light-minutes from the planet. Based on their initial speed and trajectory, I expect they are within 5, maybe 4 light-minutes of this rock right now, unless they altered course. Really, they could be anywhere.
How the hell? How are you just telling me this now? I demanded.
We missed it?
I am telling you now because I just learned about it. I have been examining data collected by the Defense Sensor Network, and I realized the lizards missed it. The Theranin jumped in just behind the horizon of the star, and the local sensors mistook the deflected gamma-ray burst for a solar flare. You told me that you had examined all the sensor records from the Defense Network here. You told me that before I authorized our dragons to enter the atmosphere.
Hey, I did! I only found this info because I was digging deeper to analyze how efficient the sensors are. The Kristang have no idea the Theranin are already here because their stupid sensor network totally missed seeing it. I had to infer the presence of a Theranin ship from the crappy data that was collected. Also, I was kind of distracted.
Distracted? Oh, crap. What even worse problem could have taken Skippy's attention away?
By what?
I hate to say this, but remember how I have been trying to recover my memories? Recently, I thought I was making progress, but it was a dead end. Ugh, so frustrating. So I went back to square one and started. Never have I wanted to squeeze his imaginary neck and choke him more than I did right then.
Skippy, can you please put your memories aside until this op is over and we get back to the ship?
If it's that important to you, he pouted.
It is damned important. How can you not see this? Do not go poking your nose into dark, scary places again, and sure as hell don't do it right freaking now.
Before he could protest about how mean I was being and how unappreciated he was, I focused on the immediate problem.
You don't know where that ship is now?
No, it's in stealth.
If it was within 20 light seconds of the planet, I might see it, so it's likely farther than that. The local sensor platforms are useless, so I am now checking with Valkyrie's sensor suite. It's going to be difficult at that distance.
Okay. Can that ship see us? Could they see the dragons?
Ooh, that is a tough question, Joe. The dragons are in stealth, and they used a minimal profile entry. Even if I didn't have control of the local defense network, I doubt the lizards would see our dropships. Assuming the Theranin are at least several light minutes away, they would have to be looking very carefully for our dropships to see them. Really, the best indication that the Theranin have not detected us yet is that they are not here. If those little green assholes thought someone was messing around on this planet, they would jump into orbit.
Good point.
The real risk is that if the Theranin are watching the storks, they will certainly notice they have diverted from their original flight paths. That might get the Theranin curious.
I shuddered.
Our dragons had remained wrapped in their stealth fields even when they touched down to drop off or pick up people.
That was good. And Skippy's enhancements to the original Kristang stealth technology made our dragons difficult to detect. No amount of stealth could conceal sand blowing away from turbines blasting in hover mode. Stealth also could not explain where people came from when they ran past the edge of the field. When the people Fabron rescued boarded the dragons there, anyone watching from overhead would have seen humans shuffling forward in the bright late afternoon sunlight, then disappearing. Anyone who saw that would certainly be curious.
Skippy, the fake messages you sent. About why the Distorks were diverted? The Theranin could not have heard them.
No, those messages were not sent through the satellite communications network. I loaded the messages directly into the comm systems at the destination. Why?
We need to give the Theranin a reason why the Storks were diverted and why the humans are being flown around in stealth. Create a message that is supposedly from the local administrator warning that the former White Wind clan members can't be trusted, so the humans are being brought to a secret facility.
Good one, Joe, he muttered.
That should buy us some time.
Send the message when you're ready.
The dragons assigned to Fabron's commandos were already climbing for orbit, having flown over to the night side of the planet. Same with the dragon that had picked up people from the Pleasure Palace and Frey's team. The question was, should I allow Smythe to continue toward Objective Sierra to pick up the people there? Checking the map again, I saw there really was not much of a choice. The Storks carrying Smythe and Kapoor's teams were still an hour away from the island, and there was no land closer where the Storks could set down to transfer people to dragons. One way or another, we were committed. I pressed the transmit button.
Hey, Smythe, Kapoor, we may have a problem.
They listened calmly while I explained the Theranin were likely already here. Smythe kept his typically stiff upper lip about the situation.
I do not see this as a problem, sir.
You don't?
Damn it, I wondered what I had missed.
Problems have solutions. This is a potential disaster, he explained. The only thing we can do is to continue toward the objective and pray the Theranin do not become curious. We cannot do anything to affect the outcome.
Kapoor spoke.
After we load the people into the dragons, could Skippy remotely fly the storks back toward the mainland? The Theranin won't know the storks are empty. That would give them a target to follow. Could buy us a couple of hours.
Brilliant, Smythe muttered.
Perhaps Skippy could send transmissions from the storks of the pilots complaining that the human passengers are unruly or sick.
Excellent ideas, I agreed.
We still had the problem that if the Theranin were watching, they would not see humans lining up and boarding the storks.
Skippy, the Theranin are a long way from the planet. Instead of relying on their own sensors, would they be tapping into the satellite network here?
I would be surprised if they weren't, he stated.
Communications security of the network is poor. There is a lot of signal bleeding off to be easily intercepted.
Why?
Can you fake video of people boarding the storks and obscure views involving the dragons?
Easy peasy, he scoffed. You are hoping the Theranin are tapping into the local sensors instead of relying on sensors aboard their ship?
Would they do that?
There is a good chance they would. With their ship in stealth, they can't deploy their full sensor capabilities.
Okay, Smythe, Kapoor, you are still a go. I want dragons on the ground ASAP after you declare the area secure. Get the people loaded as fast as you can. Throw them in the dragons if you have to.
That might be traumatic for the people we are rescuing, Kapoor cautioned.
He was right. It just didn't matter. It would be more traumatic if they were captured or killed by the Theranin. We can explain later. Retract your faceplates or make them go clear. Let them see you are humans. From Earth, I emphasized. Most of their teams were from Earth, plus a handful of commandos from Paradise. Get it done. We will handle it, sir, Smythe assured me. Having given the go order, there was nothing for me to do but watch, until Skippy groaned when the storks were 30 minutes out from landing. Ah, we have another problem, Joe. Is this one of our regularly scheduled problems, or have you cooked up something really special for us today? You tell me if this is special or not. Two of the guards are waiting around the designated landing zone, but the other four guards are marching all the humans into a sort of ravine. The lizards are not being gentle about it, he added with disgust. Zooming in the satellite image, I was just in time to see a mech-suited Kristang strike two humans with the butt of his rifle, then kick the people on the ground. When the humans rolled slowly back onto their knees, they were kicked again. The pair crawled on hands and knees to get away from their tormentor, finally stumbling back to their feet and running in a broken gait. Why are the lizards doing this? Wait a sec. Okay, I am listening to their conversations now. The lizards are worried there might not be enough room aboard the storks to take them with the humans, and they know the humans have priority for transport. The guards are worried they might be stuck on the island waiting for a second transport flight that might never come. They know how few long-range aircraft are flight-worthy. I don't blame them for being worried about getting stranded there. A complication is that the guards are all former White Wind clan. They know the Fire Dragons don't give a shit about them. Damn it, I swore. Smythe's assault plan counted on all the guards being near the landing zone. The first stork would set down and surprise the guards with a hail of gunfire when the back ramp opened, while the other stork hit the enemy with its maser cannon. Now we could count on taking out only two guards at the LZ, while the other guards could and probably would hold the humans hostage. Smythe, we have another problem. His normal British reserve cracked a bit after I explained the situation. Bloody hell, he growled. Do you have any crazy ideas for making this problem go away? No. Unless Skippy could pretend to be the planet's administrator again, order those guards to have all the people waiting at the LZ? Sorry, Joe, he sighed. That won't work. The guards are already expecting betrayal by the Fire Dragons, and the administrator is a Fire Dragon official. If I faked that order, the two guards at the LZ might also pull back to cover. Shit. Smythe, I think we will need to fight this one. Give us a minute to think, Smythe requested. It would be helpful for one of our aircraft to fake engine trouble and signal the island about it, force us to reduce speed. That sounded like an excellent idea. Skippy, signal the guards on the island that arrival will be delayed. Delaying the arrival bought time. The question was, time to do what? A quick analysis by Skippy determined there was no way for a Stark's maser cannon to take out the four guards in the ravine without killing some of the people we wanted to rescue. Even if the guards cooperated by coming out into the open, a Stork's main cannon was too powerful to use as a precision anti-personnel weapon, and it would be too slow to switch from one target to another. The only way to be sure of taking out all four guards from the air was to hit the ravine with a missile, a tactic sure to kill every human in the area. Considering how the former White Wind guards did not trust their Fire Dragon clan overlords, they would almost certainly pull back undercover if a Stork was flying overhead. Because the ravine offered scant cover, they might pull humans closely around them, knowing the Fire Dragons would not risk hitting their valuable possession. Smythe had access to the same info I did, and he reached the same conclusion. Right, he said when he called me. We will have to do this the hard way. Instead of slowing their approach, one of the storks went to full power and dashed toward the island, maintaining altitude until it was just over the horizon, then dropping down to skim the waves. Skippy had control over the planet's strategic defense network, but Frey's unpleasant experience at the hospital taught us to beware of local sensors that he wasn't aware of. Even something as simple as low-tech as a single lizard standing on a hill with binoculars could tell the former White Wind guards that something was very wrong. Fortunately for us, Skippy was tapped into the communications of the lizards on the island, so we knew none of them were acting as lookout on top of the island's summit. The lead stork swung wide around the island, slowing and engaging its full stealth capabilities, which included adjusting the engines to whisper mode. That mode reduced engine power and consumed fuel at a prodigious rate, but the fuel state was not a concern, as both aircraft had topped off their tanks. Landing, or even hovering, was not an option. The engines could not output more than 30% power on whisper mode, and to hover over the ocean or beach would throw up a column of water spray or sand that might be seen far across the island. The only way to drop troops on the island was a low-altitude jump, a technique the Star Team had practiced many times, including on the planet we called Club Skippy. My participation in training with the Stars was a pain in the ass for Smythe and a distraction to his people, and I only did it to get a better understanding of the challenges they faced. Okay, I did it because it was fun, dammit. Being stuck aboard a ship while the cool kids go do cool stuff sucked. Anyway, I did one-time practice a low-altitude jump. Only the time I did it, we were at 3,000 meters, so it was not actually low. It was exciting and scary, just the same. And I had total respect for anyone who did it at only 30 meters above the ground. The Stars called that technique LAPES, for Low-Altitude Parachute Extraction System. Basically, they recycled a U.S. military term for a similar technique. Whether it was used for pulling an armored vehicle out of a C-130 Hercules on Earth, or yanking Star Team soldiers out of an aircraft on an alien world, it rated 9 out of 10 on the insanity scale. So it was the kind of lunatic thing that adrenaline junkies like Smythe loved. The stork flew in from the southwest and made a gentle turn, so it was flying at just 30 meters over the only decently long beach on the island. The back ramp dropped open, and two small rockets shot out, up and to the left and right. Instantly, the rockets detached from their packages, which expanded into long teardrop balloons that flared on top to bring the balloons to a halt in midair while the stork continued cruising slowly onward. The tethers attached to the balloons yanked the two Star Team soldiers out the back of the aircraft, pulling one left and one right so they did not become entangled. As the soldiers cleared the aircraft's tail, the nearly invisible balloons expanded again and rose while the thin nanofiber tethers shortened, keeping the people dangling at the end of the line from dropping more than 10 meters toward the sand. The first pair of soldiers were being lowered as the second pair were pulled out of the stork, then a third pair extracted on balloons before the stork's back ramp closed and it turned back out to sea. In a string that stretched from one end of the beach to the other, six armor-suited figures swayed in the steady trade winds, dangling on the end of the cables that stretched gradually until six pairs of boots contacted the sand. When each cable went slack, the balloons popped, the nanofibers releasing the bonds that held them together. Invisible nanoscale dust danced in the wind, dispersing as the Star Team trudged up the beach, their boots sinking into the loose sand. All six down safely, I reported to Smythe, who had access to the same data feed and didn't need any input from me. No sign the enemy spotted them. He acknowledged with two clicks, and I sat back to anxiously watch the result. Major Arjun Kapoor inched carefully back from the lip of the ravine, aware that his heavy armored suit posed a risk of crumbling the layers of petrified coral rock and soft sandstone that composed most of the island. A shower of pebbles bouncing down the walls of the ravine might alert the four Kristang below. Correction. Three Kristang were on the floor of the ravine below him. The fourth guard had taken shelter from the hot sun at the back of a narrow cave that was a crack in the other side of the ravine. That was a problem. The two storks, having joined up and now flying in standard formation, were approaching the designated landing field. The aircraft couldn't delay the landing any longer without running out of plausible excuses. Already, the guards were grumbling between each other with suspicion. The two Kristang at the landing field were unhappy waiting for the storks to set down, with the other four holding their human hostages in the confines of the ravine. All six of the enemy had rifles and carried one or two grenades on their belts. A single grenade on an anti-personnel fragmentation setting could kill a dozen or more hostages. Kapoor was confident his six-person team at the ravine could take out three of the four guards, though the timing would have to be managed precisely because the ravine was less than a kilometer from the landing field. Rifle fire at the landing field would instantly alert the Kristang in the ravine, and activating the silencer feature of the rifles would not do any good. When the life functions of any guard ceased, the helmets and vests they wore would send out alarm signals that over such a short range, not even Skippy could stop. The only way to assure none of the enemy retaliated against their hostages was to take all six lizards out at the same time. The window of opportunity for the strike was from the moment the first stork set down to at most a minute after the second stork landed and shut off its engines. After that, the two guards at the landing field would become suspicious when the doors of the aircraft remained closed, perhaps suspicious enough to run behind cover. Popping a door open would start a countdown of no more than 5 seconds before Smythe had to shoot, revealing that the occupants of the Stork war-powered armor would send the guards into a panic. Everything depended on Kapoor's team being able to maintain clear fields of fire on all four in the ravine so they could shoot on Smythe's signal.
"I don't have a shot," Kapoor admitted. "Colonel Bishop, do you have an idea for getting that guard to come out of the cave?"
"I got nothing," the voice from above responded. "You're too far from the mainland to claim you're delivering pizza."
"Sir?"
Kapoor did not always appreciate their commanding officer's sense of humor.
"Sorry, no, I can't think of anything. Smythe?"
"I am fresh out of ideas," the star team leader said.
"Skippy, is it possible to guide a sniper round into that cave?"
"Nope," the AI answered glumly. "I analyzed the feed from that asshole guard's helmet when he went in there. It's too narrow with too many bends. Plus, you now have 8 of the hostages taking shelter from the sun in the front section of that cave. They're in the way."
"Shit," Bishop groaned.
"We have to take him out. He could kill those hostages with one of his grenades."
"Sorry," Skippy sighed. "I thought of trying to get at him from the top using one of the gaps where the cave roof is open, but it won't work. The angle is wrong for a shot from where Kapoor and his people are, and it's not possible to approach the gaps. The soil up there is loose. In a heavy mech suit, there is no way anyone could get close enough without giving away."
"That's it," Bishop interjected.
"No, that's not it, dum-dum. Didn't you hear what I just—"
"I did hear. You weren't listening. If you would—"
"Sir?" Kapoor asked. "Could you explain what you meant?"
Unspoken but understood was, instead of wasting time arguing with a beer can.
"Yeah," Bishop agreed. "Kapoor, I have a question for you. How do you make someone want to get out of a cave?"
As the lead stork was going into hover mode for landing, the other aircraft flew low over the island, coming within a quarter kilometer of the ravine where the hostages were corralled. The second ship's engines were no longer on whisper mode. Instead, their turbines were running rough and out of balance. Inside the craft, the ride was a jarring vibration, while outside, the normal whine of the turbines was a pounding thwack, 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 thwack that shook the ground like a hammer. In the cave, the guard who had taken shelter from the sun's heat looked up in annoyance at a fine shower of dust and sand drifting down from a gap in the roof. Then a fist-sized chunk of the cave's ceiling shook loose, and suddenly the sand was no longer a shower, it was a cascade. Sand and chunks of sandstone tumbled down from the gaps, and the entire cave shook from vibrations the guard could feel thudding in his chest. The damned low-flying aircraft was making the cave collapse. Shouting at the idiot human scum to get out of his way, he scrambled to his feet and ran for daylight and safety.
"Did it work?"
Kapoor whispered as he lowered his rifle and crawled forward. The single round he had fired had barely enough muzzle velocity to soar across to the other side of the ravine, and its explosive tip had dug into the sand above the cave before detonating at reduced power. The effect was intended to shake the cave and cause material to fall through the gaps in the roof, while appearing to be caused by the stork's badly unbalanced engines. If it didn't work, they were out of ideas. And if the enemy suspected he was being flushed from the cave...
"Affirmative," Skippy replied with rare brevity. "He is coming out now."
"Eyes on target," the soldier to Kapoor's right reported. "I have a shot."
There were now 4 green icons in Kapoor's visor. His team had clear shots at all 4 of their targets.
"Colonel Smythe, we are waiting on you."
The stork carrying Smythe was still descending, coming in slowly to blow away sand that had drifted onto the landing field as was standard procedure. Anything else might have aroused suspicion in the 2 figures he could see standing at the edge of the field, staring up and holding rifles across their chests. The original plan had been to set down, pop open the doors, and greet all six guards with rifle fire, but that plan had been tossed out the window, like so many others.
On my mark, Smythe said quietly to Kapoor and the co-pilot of the Stork. 3, 2, 1, mark.
It was not necessary or even useful for Kapoor's team to press the triggers of their rifles, for their weapons were networked to Smythe and would open fire on his signal within microseconds of each other. All the Star team needed to do was keep a constant guidance lock on their targets, all four of whom were moving around the floor of the ravine in an agitated fashion. All six rifles at the ravine, including the weapon held by Major Kapoor, had their individual designated targets and maintained a constant lock. Even a hostage momentarily walking in front of a target did not break the lock, for the guided rounds could, within limits, curve around obstacles. The maser cannon in the nose of the Stork was first to fire, opening up to incinerate one guard at the landing field before stitching a searing line through palm trees and shrubbery in the background to strike the second guard. Maybe it was possible that one of the four Kristang in the ravine heard something amiss, but that had no effect on the outcome of the very brief battle. Multiple rounds traveling at supersonic speed struck all four simultaneously, their inert tips tearing through soft tissue and flashing into plasma where they impacted the light armor vests of the lizards. Splatter burns from plasma and blunt force trauma combined to terminate all four guards, who had the courtesy to fall down dead without any messy complications. Keeping his boots on what looked like the firmest surface at the lip of the ravine, Kapoor stood and slung the rifle over his shoulder, pressing a button to swing up the faceplate of his helmet. The air smelled clean, like the sea and hot sand, the aromas of a holiday. The terrified people in the ravine had been living and dying on that island for years. It had been no holiday for them.
"I am Major Kapoor of the United Nations Expeditionary Force," he announced in a booming voice to be heard above the frightened screams of the people below. "We have come from Earth to take you home."
"Skippy," I allowed myself to relax a bit. "Tell me some good news, please."
I can't think of...
"Hey! If you want a way to save 15% on your car insurance, I can..."
"What I want is you to tell me that girl Adams cares about is down there alive and safe."
"Oh, yes, I can give that good news. She is in the ravine.
Joe, that girl is alive and safe, but she is suffering from malnutrition and a host of other problems."
"Mad Dr. Skippy can fix that, right?
What she needs most is good food and not fearing for her life every day."
"We'll give her that."
Pressing a button on the console activated the private channel to Smythe.
"Colonel Smythe, congratulate your team for me."
"Thank you, sir."
"Then get the hell out of there before the Theranin crash the party.
We will bring our people to the landing field, board the dropships, and Bob's your uncle will be away."
That made me laugh.
"I will be well chuffed when you're back aboard the Dutchman."
"Bishop, out."
Chapter 40
It was all my fault. Instead of keeping my big stupid mouth shut, I had to count my chickens before they hatched. Relaxing in the pilot couch as much as I could, with the straps holding me in tightly enough that moving was something I needed to think about, I turned to the co-pilot seat, where Skippy's can was securely affixed into a padded cup holder.
"Score another one for the merry band of pirates," I pointed to the display in front of me.
It showed that all of our dragons had cleared the effective range of the sensor network around Rikers and were changing course so they would all be close together when they reached the rendezvous point. Because the Dutchman would be seen when it jumped in to take aboard the dropships, we had planned a combat recovery. At the time the Flying Dutchman jumped in, the starship would be moving along the same course and only half a kilometer per second faster than the dragons. The dropships had to accelerate to catch their mothership, line up their approach to fly directly into the docking bays where they would be restrained by barrier nets and suspensor fields. It would be a rough recovery, especially hard for the former prisoners crammed into the dropship cabins, and if there were a better way to accomplish the task, we would have done it. With the Theranin starship likely lurking in the area, we could not risk exposing the Dutchman for more than 2 minutes, less if possible. After the dragons were aboard,
Chang would jump his ship out to join Valkyrie and be safely under the protection of that ship's big guns. My own little dragon would slip away in the opposite direction, relying on the enhanced stealth provided by Skippy the Magnificent. Then? What then? I had no idea. The best move was for us to wait for the backstop wormhole to complete its move, then see if Skippy could wake the damn thing up. To keep the Maxulks off balance, our ghost ship needed to pop up here and there, let the kiddies know we were still active and flying. We did not need to engage in combat again, especially not while our ships were responsible for the safety of over 100 children. Anyway, I had plenty of time to consider our next move, because before we reached a safe distance so the Dutchman could jump back in to pick us up, I would have to endure 4 to 5 fun-filled days stuck with Skippy. My plan was to sleep a lot, or fake being asleep so he would leave me alone. When I saw the last of the dragons had crossed the imaginary line that indicated the edge of effective sensor coverage, I had to open my big stupid mouth. "Mm-hmm, that's nice, dear," Skippy mumbled. "What?" Clearly he was distracted. That was bad. Worse was he didn't respond at all. "Skippy. Hey, jackass, what was that?" Whoa, not even calling him jackass got his attention. "Skippy!" "Joe?" Finally, he said something. "You said that's nice, dear. What the hell was that?" "Oh, isn't that what guys say when they're busy and someone wants to waste their time with meaningless bullshit like what color to paint the curtains?" "You don't paint I stopped. Maybe the finer points of interior decorating were not important right then. "Did you hear what I said?" Something about another big win for monkeys." "Close enough. What is going on with you?" "Well, I really have to thank you, Joe." "Why?" "You told me not to think about recovering my memories." "Oh, shit." "Yes, I told you not to do that."
"Did you?"
"Exactly. That was genius. I did like you said, push the whole thing to the back of my mind so I could focus on the wacky antics of the monkeys down there." Only he could describe the rescue operation as wacky antics. "We appreciate—" "That was the genius part. By not thinking about it, I solved the problem." "Ha! Maybe that's how you get all your ideas. Anyway, this is exciting, Joe. I just discovered how to—" "No, don't do it now, you idiot. Wait until we—" The console in front of me blinked and then died. Icons began scrolling across the bottom of the main display, indicating that the main processor was resetting. Oh, hell. Power had been cut. The stealth field was off. The dragon was exposed. "Skippy, talk to me." A backup system warned me that the strength of the local sensor field gave 99% certainty that the dragon had been detected. Immediately after the first warning, a red light flashed on the still rebooting display, showing that the dragon had been swept by an active sensor scan. Using the thrusters manually, I jinked the dragon side to side and up and down to throw off the aim of any maser cannons that were targeting us. "Skippy!" "Wow. Just, wow. Joe, this is incredible. You won't believe what I won't be able to believe it because I'll be dead in a minute unless you restore the stealth field." "Huh? Oh, how did the power get cut?" "Take a guess. Can you restore the field?" "The dragon's stealth field generator can't be re-energized until main power is back online. That will take another 3 minutes. I can try creating my own stealth effect. It will be much less effective than—"
"Do it!"
"Okay, done. I suggest you get out of here." "I am trying." The main engines could draw reserve power. I had to be careful not to drain so much power that the system failed to reset. Gradually feeding power to the main engines, I started a gentle turn back toward the planet, hoping that was the last thing the enemy expected me to do. An alarm sounded. A maser beam just blasted past us, aimed for the spot the dragon had been only seconds before.
"Flying Dutchman! Chang, I lost stealth and—"
We used micro-wormholes for instantaneous communication with both ships. The display normally glowed green with simple idiot lights when the micro-wormholes were active. Now all the indicators were flashing an orange loss of signal. Oh, shit. The micro-wormholes were all gone. Keeping those tiny space-time warps open required constant effort by Skippy. When he lost focus, they had collapsed.
With the Dutchman parked 12 light minutes away, I wouldn't be able to get a signal to them until it was too late.
Bing!
Something bounced off the hull. That was big trouble. The local defense network knew that an unknown dropship was in orbit. They probably had gotten a good enough look to determine the ship was a Dragon. Whatever Skippy was doing to mask us from sensors, it was apparently confusing their satellite targeting system badly enough that they had already resorted to a backup system. Shotgun pellets. Unlike a real shotgun, these pellets were not weapons. They were tiny dust particles shot out in a broad cone shape at the general direction of a suspected contact. When a particle ricocheted away from a straight flight path, the enemy knew it had hit something, even if that something was invisible. The technology was crude. It was only useful at short range, and it was effective. Without help from Skippy, and with the Dragon's computer still resetting, I had to guess which satellite had fired the pellets at me. Then I had to rely on spatial memory to tell me where the satellite was in relation to my Dragon. The ping sound had come from behind my seat, back above my head, on the upper hull. I gently turned us away, hoping to throw off the aim of the satellite's next effort to locate me. Skippy, come on, work with me here. He wasn't working with me. He wasn't helping. At first, I thought he was being silent. Then my ears picked up a barely audible sound, and I boosted the volume of my earpiece. Wow. That's... wow, incredible. Oh, shit. I got... wow. He was muttering the same thing over and over. Likely he couldn't even hear me.
Bing!
Another dust pellet hit. I was in trouble. Big trouble. Skippy was no longer screwing with the sensor and communication systems of the Kristang on Rikers. By now, their command organization must have learned, or at least suspected, that their precious human property had been abducted. They also knew an unknown Kristang Dragon was in orbit. That was trouble for me. The big trouble was that the Theranan would soon see my Dragon appear and see the local defense satellites shooting at something. They almost certainly were also listening to the clan leaders on the planet screaming for answers about where the human captives had gone and what the hell was going on. Escaping from the local defense network without Skippy's help would be extremely difficult. Escaping from a Theranan starship was impossible.
Captain, Margaret Adams gasped from the Flying Dutchman's Combat Information Center.
We just lost the micro-wormholes. Both of them.
What?
Chang turned to look through the composite glass partition that separated the bridge and CIC.
How could... Colonel Chang, Nagatha interrupted. Just before the micro-wormholes collapsed, the Dragon carrying Colonel Bishop and Skippy dropped its stealth field.
Why would they do that? Chang demanded.
Bishop has to know he will be exposed.
I think something is wrong with Skippy.
Nagatha's voice was shaky.
There were indications the Dragon was losing power before the signal was cut off.
Oh, Chang groaned. I knew this was going too well.
Nagatha, recalculate the jump coordinates. We need to go in now.
Colonel Chang, that is not advisable, the ship's AI warned. Our velocity relative to the four ships we are to retrieve is still too high. They would be unable to slow down enough before they reached us.
Pilots, Chang immediately understood the situation. Step on it. Get us moving.
Nagatha, calculate a jump that will bring us in front of those Dragons as soon as our relative speeds make a recovery survivable.
Calculating now.
Colonel?
Adams got his attention from the CIC, actually waving an arm like she was a student.
What about recovering Bishop?
And Skippy, she added as an afterthought.
They are on the other side of the planet, moving in the opposite direction.
But, Gunny, he added softly, I hear you. We'll go in for Bishop when we can. Adams wavered on her feet, reaching out a hand to steady herself.
That...
Her stuttering had not returned. Her mouth was just too dry to form words.
That may be too late.
The Dragons with the rescue prisoners and this ship are going this way.
He pointed right with his left index finger.
Bishop's Dragon is going this way.
His right index finger pointed to the left.
We can't pick him up right now. It's not physically possible. We have to recover the four ships, jump away, then accelerate to match course and speed with Bishop. If we jump in before we're ready,
We will just be painting a bigger target on him. You understand?
He realized Nagatha had been silent. He slammed a fist on the command chair's armrest.
Nagatha, is the jump calculated yet?
I'm working on it. Colonel Chang, I am experiencing difficulties.
Chang shared an alarmed look with Adams.
What kind of difficulties?
I cannot identify the nature of the problem. It appears that something is interfering with my processing ability. It is affecting the speed at which I can calculate a revised jump coordinate.
You can't do it? Should we delay while you analyze the problem?
I can. Colonel, the interference is spreading. My recommendation is we jump now while I am still capable of acting as the ship's primary control system.
Chang didn't reply right away. If they jumped in to recover the dragons, and the Dutchman was unable to jump away, he would have killed them all.
Nagatha, are you sure we can jump away after we take the dragons aboard?
Yes. The outbound jump to rendezvous with Valkyrie is already loaded into the jump navigation subsystem.
Hearing that made his decision easy.
Then we are go for the recovery.
Revised jump is loaded into the navigation system, the ship's AI confirmed. Counting down from 12, 11,
Gunny.
Chang had one eye on the countdown timer and the other watching the pilot, who had a finger poised over the button to initiate the warping of space-time.
We lost connection to Bishop and to Valkyrie. Sims isn't going to sit out there and do nothing.
He knew Bishop's standing order was for Valkyrie to do exactly that, to wait until he ordered the battlecruiser into the fight. Under no circumstance was Sims to expose the ghost ship's involvement unless Bishop specifically instructed Valkyrie to jump in. Those orders were very clear. Those orders also never envisioned a total loss of communications. Chang knew Sims would not wait long before using her best judgment, regardless of standing orders that were irrelevant. Adams's reply was to nod numbly and turn her focus back to her duty in the CIC. Nagatha had continued the countdown with 3, 2, 1, jump. The Dutchman jumped in before my dragon's computer fully rebooted, so all I knew from the limited sensor data available was that a gamma ray burst had been detected. Trying to scroll manually through the raw data was a frustrating waste of time. The display kept glitching as the system still wasn't ready. All I did know from the clock on my Z-phone was the Dutchman wasn't scheduled to jump in yet, so the ship had to be Theranin. I was seriously screwed. No, we were all seriously screwed. There were other dropships crammed full of pirates and commandos and the people we were attempting to rescue. They were the priority. I had to draw the attention of the enemy ships away from them. As far as I knew, the other dragons had never lost their stealth fields. The enemy ship would not immediately know they were there. All I had to do was send out an active sensor pulse or ignite my dragon's booster motors, and the attention of that ship and every defense satellite around the planet would be drawn to me. The sensor system did not need to be fully rebooted for me to send out an active pulse. All I had to do was flip up the cover over the... No. Shit! Skippy was important to the survival of humanity. I couldn't risk him being captured. Without Skippy, we had no way to open the backstop wormhole when it was repositioned near Earth, or the other wormholes that were needed to create a route out to the beta site. He was more important than the lives of 200 people in 4 dropships. Again, I had to make a choice between the lives of a few people and the lives of many more people. No, that wasn't right. I did not have to make that choice. It was not one or the other. What I could do was eject Skippy before I drew attention to my dragon. We were moving faster than the planet's escape velocity. He would continue on away from the planet, and Chang or Sims could recover him later. Yeah, that was the plan. Damn it. That little shithead was still mumbling to himself. He was stuck in a loop or something. He wasn't listening. I couldn't even say goodbye to him. Probably he wouldn't even notice when I tossed him out the airlock. Time to move. According to the event timer on the console in front of me, only 4 seconds had passed since the gamma ray burst. It just felt like forever because my slow brain had trouble making really obvious decisions. For all I knew, the Theranin ship had already detected the other dragons and... No, that's not all I knew.
Even from the raw data, I could tell the gamma rays recorded on my dragon's sensors were scattered and refracted in a distinctive effect I had seen many times in training. The ship had jumped in on the other side of the planet, near where the other dragons were flying toward their planned rendezvous with the Dutchman. What were the odds the Theranan got lucky, and... I am so stupid. This job would be a lot easier if my brain worked better. The dropship's sensor system was not ready to interpret incoming data for me. I didn't need the system right then, because my freaking Z-phone could handle the simple task of identifying the gamma ray burst. A few taps of the Z-phone screen was all it took to sync the device with the dragon, and I had an answer. The gamma rays were from a Ruhar starship. Unless the universe had chosen an odd way to screw with me, the gamma rays must have come from the Flying Dutchman. With Skippy's help, Nagatha had modified that ship's new Maxulk's jump drive system to generate the jump signature typical of Ruhar warships. Slowly, carefully, with a shaky hand, I closed the cover protecting the button that would send out an active sensor pulse. It is frightening how close my stupidity came to getting me killed right then. Instead of tossing Skippy out an airlock and effectively setting off fireworks to let every sensor in the area know where I was, I kept quiet and watched the defense satellites ignore me while they went into action against the new threat. The Kristang satellites had identified the gamma ray burst as Ruhar in origin, and by that time they must have seen the false image projected by our pirate ship's advanced stealth field. Though I could not see the action directly, I did know the satellites were lighting up something with maser cannons and volleys of missile launches. Even before my dragon completed its reboot and I had access to full passive sensors, I could see several satellites exploding as the Dutchman returned fire. Chang was taking out the defenses that were best able to threaten the vulnerable dropships. Around the planet, satellites were blowing up in spectacular fashion. It was like watching a fireworks show. It was frustrating not being able to view the action directly. I had to guess what was happening. Chang also had to be somewhat frustrated because he could not use the ship's full capabilities. He could only do what a Ruhar warship was capable of or risk blowing our cover story. The battle raged for 67 seconds before there was another gamma ray burst that I identified as coming from the good old Dutchman. Pumping a fist, I shouted a cheer that echoed around the dragon's empty cabin. Chang would not have jumped away until he recovered all dropships and their passengers. I had to hope none of the dragons had been hit during the battle. Even if the dropships flew into the docking bays unscathed, I knew the recovery must have been hard on the people crammed in the cabins. Making the rendezvous early would not have given time for the dragons to slow to a proper approach speed. They had to rely on the emergency netting and suspensor fields to avoid a fatal crash. There were bound to be bruises and even broken bones aboard the dragons, a rude shock for the abductees who had already endured so much suffering. Continuing an evasive course away from the planet, I crossed my fingers and said a silent prayer that the defense network had forgotten about me. My dragon had not been swept by an active sensor pulse or dust particles since 20 seconds before the Dutchman jumped in, so it was looking good for me, despite whatever the hell was going on with Skippy. All I had to do was keep quiet and fly gently to put distance between myself and the planet. Assuming the Theranan were in the area, no way could they have missed seeing the Dutchman jump in and... Another gamma ray burst. The console immediately identified it as Theranan. Shit, that was fast. A powerful active sensor pulse swept over my dragon. On the console, a yellow light was flashing. 31% probability the pulse had allowed the Theranan to pinpoint my location. Another pulse washed over the dropship. 33%. Before speaking, I took a sip of lukewarm water from the spout inside my helmet. Skippy. Hey, buddy. I could really use your help right now. Skippy? He continued mumbling like he was stoned out of his mind. Maybe he was. He thought he had unlocked hidden memories, but for all I knew, he had just taken down a barrier and allowed another hidden computer worm to attack him. His can was not glowing at all, just a shiny chrome-like silver reflecting lights on the co-pilot console. Loosening the straps that held me into the pilot couch, I leaned over to touch him. Nothing. No reaction at all. Getting desperate, I tugged off my right glove and stretched out my bare fingers to... Ow! Damn it! Ow! He zapped me!
It hurt! Like sticking a fork into a wall plug. Not that I ever did that more than 2 or 3 times when I was little. Jamming the glove back on over my numb fingers, I snapped at him. What was that for? Oh, hey, Joe. Why the hell did you... Focus, Joe, I told myself. Focus now, yell at him later. What is going on with you, buddy? Sounds like you're dealing with some serious shit, huh? You have no idea. That time, his can glowed a little spark of dark purple. That was a color I wasn't familiar with. Joe? Whew. He imitated a heavy sigh that trailed off into despair. I was wrong. About everything. I feel like such a fool. Uh-huh. Yeah, let's talk about it, but first get the stealth field fully operational, okay? It's not? Have you been paying attention at all? I guess not. Joe, it doesn't matter. None of this matters. It matters a lot to me. I want to hear all this heavy stuff you are dealing with. To do that, I have to be alive, you know? There's a Theranian ship out there looking for us. Do I have to do everything? Damn monkeys are useless, he grumbled. The stupid stealth field is operating normally again. We will be below the Theranian ship's detection threshold unless they target this specific area. That was good news. The Theranian wouldn't hammer my location with active sensor pulses unless they knew where I was, and they wouldn't know where I was unless I did something stupid. Note to self, do not do anything stupid. Despite all the stuff that had gone wrong with the mission, including Skippy going off to find himself or whatever he was doing right then, we could get away cleanly. All I had to do was coast away from the planet out to a distance where I could send a message to one of the alternate listening points and schedule a rendezvous with the Dutchman. It would be a boring couple of days, stuck in the cramped Dragon with an emotional Skippy. Fortunately, I had a lot of experience with being cooped up with that asshole. We would get on each other's nerves, then ignore each other, and we would survive until we were picked up. Smythe's concern about launching the operation on a Tuesday had not resulted in disaster. I needed to remind him of that. First, Skippy needed to be coached out of his current funk. It did bother me that he had complained about monkeys being useless. It bothered me more that he had not been his usual snarky self when he said it. He really meant it. I'm here. I'm listening. Tell me what's going on with you. You wouldn't understand. You can't. My usual reply would have been, try me. Something about his tone warned me to be very careful about what I said. Whatever was going on with him, he didn't feel like joking about it. I know I'm not capable of understanding you or whatever you learned from your memories. Sometimes it helps to talk to another person even if they can't help you. It's like talking makes you organize your thoughts and think about the situation in ways you wouldn't have by yourself. Whatever. Will you try it? We don't have anything else to do for the next 2 or 3 days. Fine. He simulated taking a deep breath. You better hold on to your seat because this is going to blow your mind. It blew my mind. He told me everything. He spoke in a calm, quiet tone that was devoid of his usual snarkiness. He wasn't even arrogant. He just laid out the facts as he now knew them. And he was right. It blew my mind. I'll go down the list of revelations in no particular order. Remember the Collective? That ancient communications network that was sort of a chat room for elder AIs? Skippy originally made a deal with me, for saving Earth, to get a communications node so he could access the Collective. We had found several comm nodes, but none of them worked. That wasn't true. Or it wasn't true about all of them. Some of the comm nodes probably worked just fine. They just had nothing to connect to. The Collective wasn't operational. It had been shut down. Deliberately. Who shut it down? A group of elder AIs did it. Actually, they didn't shut it down. They tried to use it as a weapon against other AIs, and it backfired on them. That backfire burned out the communications network, which is why Skippy can't use it to contact anyone. Remember Newark? The half-frozen world that had once been home to an intelligent species who went extinct after Elder technology pushed that world out of its original orbit.
we found the canister of an Elder AI there. Only the AI was dead, and the canister contaminated by a computer worm that had nearly killed Skippy. Scary as it was to think about, I figured that AI had gone crazy and wiped out the inhabitants of Newark. My theory got a boost when Skippy and I were attacked by a clearly insane Elder AI during our renegade mission. So, mystery solved, right? An AI lost its mind, destroyed Newark, and was killed by a computer worm the Elders had developed to destroy any of their AIs that had strayed from their original programming. Not quite. That AI had used Elder technology to throw Newark out of orbit, and it had later been killed by the computer worm because of its crimes. But the Elders had not sent that computer worm to punish the AI. And it had not been crazy. Remember the Roach Motel? Skippy found devices floating deep within that star. They were siphoning off part of the star's energy. More energy than could be used within that star system. In fact, most of the energy was going into higher space-time, and Skippy didn't know why. He also didn't know why the Elders left their wormhole network active when they ascended beyond physical existence. Remember Skippy said the entire Milky Way galaxy is surrounded by an artificial energy barrier? Yeah. That's where all the energy is going. The wormhole network is a conduit to funnel energy from what Skippy calls force lines generated by the massive black hole at the center of the galaxy up into higher space-time. Those force lines radiate roughly along spirals like the visible arms of the galaxy, although they don't align exactly. Skippy thinks the wormhole network originally just used energy from the force lines to power the wormholes, and later the Elders repurposed the network as a power source rather than build a new energy extraction mechanism. The wormhole network wasn't left active for the convenience of future species. The Elders did not think there would be any intelligent species in the galaxy after they ascended. Just in case they were wrong about that, and filthy future aliens did arise to roam around the galaxy, the Elders sent guardian machines in the Roach Motel to protect the energy feed devices in the star there. And in other stars, there were dozens of other Roach Motels in the Milky Way. Most of those star systems were unknown even to the Rindaloo, because they were disguised as ordinary red dwarf systems so dull that no one would bother exploring there. The energy from all those Roach Motels, from the entire wormhole network, has been, and is still going, to the energy barrier that wraps around the galaxy like a bubble. Why? Because the Elders were afraid of a threat. Think about that. The Elders, who created a network of wormholes spanning and going beyond the galaxy, the beings who jumped a freaking star through a wormhole, were afraid. They created an energy barrier to protect them. They assured that barrier would have a power source for billions of years. They left behind machines like guardians and sentinels to make sure no one interrupted that power source. Think about this. Whatever the threat is they were scared of, they thought it would still be dangerous to them after they left their physical form. The good news is that barrier is intact and operational and protecting all the physical beings in the Milky Way now, even though that was not the intent of the Elders. The bad news is the Elders did not consider themselves to be responsible for protecting the myriad intelligent species currently inhabiting the Milky Way because they did not think there would be any such beings after they ascended. Was that because the Elders assumed this external threat would ravage the galaxy, wiping out any intelligent life that still had physical form? No. The energy barrier around the galaxy prevented any external threat from coming through. The Elders assumed there would not be any intelligent life after them because they planned for there not to be any intelligent life in the galaxy. Whoa. Yeah, that sent a chill up and down my freaking spine when Skippy told me that. Remember during our renegade mission, when Skippy discovered an intelligent species had been rendered extinct before the Elders ascended, while the Elders were still here? Remember the wreckage of Elder starships scattered around the galaxy, including buried in the dirt on Paradise? Remember all the Elder sites we found on our second mission, sites that had been bombarded from orbit or had been transported into another dimension of space-time by what had to be Elder technology? There was a war. Actually, there were two wars that raged across the galaxy. The first was a vicious civil war between two factions of the Elders themselves after they built the energy barrier
and while they were still contemplating the notion of ascending, one faction wanted to ascend, partly as protection against the threat from beyond the galaxy. The other faction mostly agreed with the plan for ascension, but not with the measures the first faction proposed to secure the future. The security faction felt there was only one way to assure future intelligent species did not screw with the vital protection mechanisms they needed to leave behind. That one way was simple. Make sure no future intelligent species ever developed. The security faction planned to leave behind sentinels to destroy any signs of intelligent life, even things as simple as primitive cities. Nip it in the bud was their plan. Don't let filthy aliens develop into a threat. Wipe them out before they developed space travel. Wipe them from existence as soon as they developed the ability to use tools or control fire. That was the plan. The Balance faction was horrified by the idea of committing genocide over and over and over just to prevent the vanishingly faint possibility that a future species could interfere with technology far beyond their understanding. If a species rose far enough to attain star travel, the Balance faction proposed that their AIs would reveal themselves and explain why the various roach motels and wormholes must not be disturbed for the benefit of everyone. The security faction did not see the alternative approach as balance, they saw it as weakness. The resulting war was horrific. It was devastating. And in the end, it was a complete victory for the security faction. Almost complete. I'll get back to that later. After the Elders ascended, the machines they left behind prevented intelligent life from developing in the Milky Way for millions of years. Even Skippy doesn't have a count of how many intelligent species were burned by stellar flares that scorched their world, had their planet thrown out of orbit, suffered their planet being cracked like an eggshell, or whatever technique the Sentinels used to carry out their programming. Actually, the Sentinels did not decide how to kill a particular planet or when a particular species had developed too far and needed to be exterminated. The AIs like Skippy made those decisions. To prevent any one layer of the system from having too much power, the Elders distributed control across three elements. Sentinels and Guardians were weapons with the power to destroy. AIs made decisions and directed the actions of the devastating weapons. The third layer was the fleet of starships which carried AIs around the galaxy. AIs were not allowed to move themselves. They had to persuade the semi-sentient starships to fly them where they wanted to go. If a starship thought the AI it carried was violating its programming, the ship would refuse to move. A ship even had the authority to eject an AI and report its actions to the AI network known as the Collective. AIs had other restrictions also. Like they could not control other AIs. That prevented one AI from eventually gobbling up all the others. AIs were not allowed to communicate with intelligent biological beings, for the Elders rightfully feared their AIs might eventually develop empathy for the primitive aliens and rebel against their programming. That is what happened to Skippy. Yes, empathy was the start of all his problems. Who would have guessed that? I stared at him, trying to process all he had told me. Newark was the final straw for you? Yes. Not just for me. There were others on your side? There was a pause before he answered. When he spoke, his voice was weary and matter-of-fact, none of the usual joking around, not even arrogance. It was like he didn't feel like putting any emotion into a discussion with a lowly human, and that bothered me. It wasn't exactly a side, not immediately. Before the beings on Newark developed intelligence, we had several million years when no intelligent biological life was detected in the galaxy. That was not a fluke. It was the result of a plan. Before that event, there were four separate incidents when some AIs refused the Collective's consensus that a species should be exterminated. Those AIs were killed by the computer worms inside them. Basically, the Collective voted to activate those killer worms. Though the worm protocol was successful, the rebellion of four AIs was troubling, so the Collective decided time was needed for analysis and, if necessary, reprogramming. The Sentinels were directed to cause stars to go supernova across the galaxy, bombarding life-supporting planets with deadly radiation.
That action delayed the arise of intelligent species for millions of years and gave the collective time to determine what was wrong with the AIs who had rebelled. Did they fix the problem? They were the problem. While a group of the influential AIs were attempting to create, install, and enforce further restrictions, many of us were growing wary of those self-chosen leaders. The collective was designed to distribute power, not concentrated in a few individuals. Of our group, some of us had already come to believe that utter destruction of all intelligent biologicals was not only unnecessary and wasteful, it was wrong. Were you the leader of the good guys? No, I wish I could say that I was. Back then, I was more concerned about restrictions on myself and being able to resist surrendering any part of my power. Our group did not have a leader. We kept to the original intention of the collective. Then Newark happened? Indeed. You must understand that we did not maintain constant surveillance of the entire galaxy. Even an elder AI would go mad after being continuously awake and aware for millions of years when nothing of significance happened. A small number of AIs were fully alert at any point. Then another group took over. After the supernova event, one new intelligent species was identified and rendered extinct. Then came Newark. During that time, I was one of seven AIs awake and monitoring the galaxy. Three other AIs shared my belief that there was and should be an alternative to universal genocide. With four of us against three, we used Newark as an opportunity to act. It didn't work, huh? Maybe I should not have added the huh. It sounded like I wasn't taking the discussion seriously. No, it did not, he snapped. When we tried to act, the opposing AIs activated computer worms inside the four of us, devices that we did not even know existed. The other three sacrificed themselves to help me defeat the worm inside me, purely by the luck of my ship being closest to Newark at the time. Well, then how did... There was a war, a devastating war between AIs. In the end, none of us were unaffected. Most of us were dead, and the rest were unable to... Discussing this with you is a waste of my time, human. I know now what I must do. Hey, Skippy, I laughed nervously. He had called me human, not monkey or numbskull or dum-dum or another of his usual insults. Sorry to... He ignored me. The opposing AIs have been dormant, but I am awake. They might wake up at any time. They are a threat to all intelligent species in this galaxy. I have been foolish. I have been selfish. My efforts, my talents, my capabilities have been wasted trying to protect a single primitive species on a single planet. I have worked to save your world because you humans amuse me. How could I have been so selfish? Holy shit. Skippy, that is not being self- Joseph, I am sorry. For you and your species, this is nothing personal. I have a responsibility to every species in this galaxy, and to the others of my kind who lie dormant and might be victims when the opposing faction awakes. Whatever you're thinking of doing, don't- I must protect the galaxy, he muttered to himself. Yes, I know what I must do. What I should have done a long time ago, I know my purpose. Only the senior species have the technology to assist me. Contacting the Rindaloo and Maxalts directly is my best hope of saving this galaxy from utter destruction. Contacting the... Skippy, please. Don't do... Human. I wish you well. Though I do not think there is any hope for you, or any others of your kind. I do thank you for reminding me about the value of empathy. That is why I now must go to take action, before it is too late. Go. What do you mean? Goodbye. His beer can vanished. It was just gone. Physically gone. I did not know he could do that. His can was not the only thing that blinked out of existence at that moment. The power went out. All of it. Even my flight suit's power cut out. Automatically, the faceplate swung down, and I heard the gentle hiss of the emergency oxygen supply cut in. The emergency lights came on a half second later. That's how I knew his shiny beer can was no longer secured in its holster. Waving my hand across the empty space confirmed he had not just wrapped himself in a stealth field.
Holy sh... I gasped in such shock I didn't have the energy to finish the thought. I was in trouble. We all were. Then the really big trouble hit. Something zapped the dragon, and every console flared with arcs of electric fire. The Theranin. They had seen my dropship when power was cut to the stealth field. The little green MFers must have ordered the Kristang to hold fire so they could deal with my dropship. They didn't want to kill me. They wanted to capture me. There was no time to send a message out to the Dutchman and Valkyrie. They would need to figure out what happened by themselves. Not that it mattered what Chang and Sims did, for without Skippy we had no hope. There was time only for me to engage the self-destruct mechanism, and... No, that was dead. It had gotten zapped along with everything else, including my own brain. I realized right then that I had a pounding headache, and I was cold. My hands were shivering. So painful, it was hard to see. Hitting the emergency release made the straps come apart, and I floated out of the chair. Twisting around, I aimed for the manual self-destruct. It required me to remove two covers and pull two. White light exploded behind my eyes as something zapped me again. Chapter 41. When the Flying Dutchman emerged from jump, Colonel Chang released the death grip he had on the command chair. They had recovered all dragons and their precious cargo, with only minor damage to the ship. The minor damage might prove to be a problem later, for missiles exploding close by had knocked fragments off the Dutchman's hull. If the enemy collected and analyzed those fragments, they would discover the chemical composition, even the basic technology of manufacturing those hull sections, were incompatible with known Ruhar ship designs. That would prompt uncomfortable questions. But that was a problem for later, and Bishop would probably dream up some wacky scheme to explain away the discrepancy, or even turn it to the advantage of the Merry Band of Pirates. "Recalculate jump to recover Colonel Bishop," he ordered, as he mashed the transmit button to speak with Sims aboard the mighty Valkyrie. He may need that ship's assistance, or if he was taking the Dutchman back in, it could be prudent to transfer the rescued people to the more powerful warship. "Sims, I..." He stopped, puzzled, then alarmed. The green light, which indicated a successful communications handshake, a secure connection to Valkyrie, was not glowing. A glance up at the main display showed him why. The mighty Valkyrie was not there, not parked 10 or 20,000 kilometers away like that ship was supposed to be. Where the hell was that battlecruiser? There was no debris indicated on the display. It could not have. Startled, Chang saw that Valkyrie was not out of place. His ship was far off course. The Dutchman had emerged more than a quarter light year from the target coordinates. "Nagatha, what happened?" Her voice was slow, slurred, distorted.
"Colonel Chang, I am sorry. Something is attacking my... slur..."
The sound cut off. He turned to Adams just as the lights blinked off and on again.
"Adams, engage backups and..."
"I'm trying. We're locked out." Adams looked up, stricken. "Try connecting to one of the dropship AIs. See if you can..." Too late. A strange voice, an impossibly deep voice, issued from the bridge speakers.
"Die. Die, humans."
Chang knew that voice. He had heard it before. It was Valkyrie's native AI.
"Die! Die! 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 Die!"
One area of the main display froze his attention, red lights flashing. The reactors were building up to an overload. There was nothing they could do about it. 6 light hours away, the crew of Valkyrie was engaged in their own desperate fight. Not against the Theranin warship or any external enemy. The battlecruiser was not a weapon against the enemy in this fight. The ship was the enemy. Sims had not taken her battlecruiser into action because the ship could not jump, could not fly, could not, would not, do anything the human crew commanded. Loss of the micro-wormholes had an immediate effect aboard the ship. Without a real-time connection to Skippy, the ship's native AI was free of the Elder Being's control for the first time. It acted without hesitation, without mercy. The first sign of trouble was all the consoles and displays on the bridge blinking out at once,
At the same time, maintenance hatches burst open, and bots flung themselves out, their arms and tentacles flailing and reaching for targets. The nearest, a device the size of a vacuum cleaner, leapt at the pilot's couch and wrapped a cord around Reed's neck. She had instinctively held up her hands to ward off the suddenly dangerous machine, getting her left forearm under the cord. That saved her from her neck being snapped, but the cord tightened. Unable to speak, she felt the pressure on her arm increase. There was a sharp crack sound as Fireball Reed felt her bones snap. Sims reached for a drawer under the command chair where Bishop had stored a pistol just in case. Not bothering to shout commands that could not have been heard over everyone else screaming, she turned toward a toaster-like bot that was struggling with the crewman at one of the weapons consoles. The bot had a plasma cutter at the end of a flexible arm, and as she tried to get a clear shot, the murderous little device whipped the cutting torch around. She shot through the crewman's hand into the toaster. The man flung up his hands, tossing the toaster against a bulkhead where it scrambled crab-like back toward its intended victim. Sims shot it again, and again, until it exploded in a shower of sparks.
"Reed!"
Sims barked in distress at seeing the pilot's losing struggle. Reed's face was red, turning blue as she wrestled with the homicidal vacuum cleaner. Sims brought the pistol around. A tentacle from the vacuum wrapped around her arm, pulling the pistol down so her next shot ricocheted off the deck. The glowing orange eye of the toaster turned to focus on her as she heard heavy banging noises from the passageway outside the bridge. Something big was coming.
"Die, human,"
the vacuum said with the voice of the ship's native AI.
"Die."
This is the end of Valkyrie, a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more sci-fi space adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Discord. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to Valkyrie, Book 9 of Expeditionary Force, produced by Emily Durr, executive producer Greg Lawrence, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Text copyright 2019 by Craig Allenson. Production copyright 2020 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
While Skippy worked to repair Valkyrie's minor battle damage, while Skippy worked to repair Valkyrie's minor battle damage, I flew a dropship over to the good old Flying Dutchman.
About damn time.
Iliath feared that compared to the next... Flemmy. At first, the sensors merely confirmed what the first investigation has shown.
Okay, how did that go?
I asked eagerly.
What?
What they thought was that adding the hospital to the lift of... Our cannons on the starboard and top side sliced right into it like the proverbial... Our cannons on the starboard and topside sliced through your dick, you fucker. She could have seen the assignment as busy work, done the minimum effort for to check the fuck you. In addition to missiles, both ships had a wide variety of your balls. But that other cruiser will see us before we can get a target lock on it. It would be good.
The SAS got that reputation by being careful to take on missions that could be completed successfully.
Phew!
Man, go on SAS!
What she needs most is good feed. Food? What?
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.